incident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the start of another night. I think this is the fifth night now. And there are four streams coming up. This is the sixth night. And there are four interviews coming up. In 2 hours, it'll be Ryan Roger Athey, and then John Carter, and then Fortisax, and then there will be the Midway AME, which is something I started last year. It's just a bit of fun at the end of each, at the end of the night. And but first, it is a stream that I think a lot of people have been looking forward to. And it's someone that I've admired for a long time. I think a lot of people have. Steve Laws. Steve Laws is an activist and a very active tweeter as well. Steve, I'll let you introduce yourself because I think that's generally the best idea. Welcome to Millennial.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Matt. I appreciate it. So for those that don't know me, I'm a member of the Homeland Party, the Kent branch organiser. And most people probably remember me for my activism down in Dover around illegal immigration. So I used to stand there filming the boats coming over and sort of reporting on what was going on down on the coast. And that was sort of my activism that grew. So I think that's how most people sort of know and recognise me from, is the boats work. That's probably the easiest way to do it.
Yeah. When was that? Was that around 2020?
It was around 2019, late 2019, early 2020 when I started. And when I did, it's weird looking back on it now to say that no one really knew that what was going on or how bad the scale was, considering it's everyday talking point now. But at the time, no one really did know what was going on. No one knew they was getting picked up by the border force, loaded on coaches, taken to hotels. No one knew any of this because they hadn't seen it. And then once we started putting that out, it's kind of went everywhere. Everyone was shocked. And then the more you do it, the more you realize how bad everything was. And you kind of get borderline, I wouldn't say obsessed is the right word, but you kind of get motivated to find out more. And it's just an ongoing thing.
There's so much that could be said about this. I think in a way all of this comes from 2015 with the migrant crisis at the end of that year, September. It seems that that was when all of this stepped up and really became a sort of industry. I'm sure it must have existed before then. It only makes sense that it did, that there were precursors to it. But after then, after 2015, it just seems to have been a relentless flood and very much accommodated, facilitated by NGOs, by governments, charities. It's not something that's happening, because I think a lot of people still, and this is something you'll come up against, a lot of people still have this idea that it's like it was in 20 years ago, where migrants would find their own way here and then they would integrate and so and it would all be off their own bat, their own what's the word, initiative. Whereas what's actually happening nowadays is industrial, like massive numbers of men, mostly men, are being carted over, and then there's another NGO to receive them at the shore, at the coast, and then another NGO to look after them and shelter them here, and then another charity or something to get them long-term housing, and then that's handled by Serco, which is a huge corporation. I mean, do you think that the public is that accurate that I've just painted that picture? And do you think the public,
somewhat.
Yeah, you go for it then. It's probably you're more familiar with the intricacies of this.
So you're right about the activists and the NGOs encouraging them to come over. There's a lot of them, for instance, even if you're going way back, but we just talk back in terms of how they come to the UK, because if I start going down the routes of Europe and everywhere else, it becomes, we'd have hours to talk about it. But ultimately, yes, the NGOs, they encourage them through to Northern Europe, through to Western Europe, and then ultimately to Northern France is where the camps are that we will see those problems. There used to be the jungle that got shut down, and everyone assumed when the jungle got shut down, the problem had gone away. But the problem hadn't gone away. It had just been scattered along the coast. So rather than having one massive location, there was now dozens of locations scattered across the coast. And then there's a massive smuggling network since you always hear the conspiracies of the smugglers aren't real, and there's a lot of people that put this nonsense out, but they are real. I track the smugglers daily. It's a lucrative business. Even if you arrest all of the people in France tomorrow, whole new wave of people just come through and step into those roles and continue it. The only way to stop these is by physically stopping them coming to our country, but that's beside the point from where we're going. Ultimately, so from there, once they've made contact with smugglers, they'll have what you'd call like burner boys in the camp. So these burner boys are essentially like middlemen between the illegals and the smugglers. And what they'd do is they'd sort of acquire customers, and then from there, they'd either get a dinghy route over, a seat on a dinghy, or they would go in the back of a lorry if they took that route. And then from usually what will happen, in the early days it was different. When I first started covering, dinghies were coming the whole way over and they were landing on the beaches and they were disappearing. There are the odd beach landing that does still happen, but it's very few and far between now. Because what happens is the border force go out and meet the illegals in the middle of the channel, pick them up, bring them back to the UK. If it's not the border force doing it, it's the RNLI, which is what you meant by NGOs bringing them over. But that's more, it's a bit of a tricky one with the RNLI, because the work they do besides the illegals is very good. If you live in a coastal town, you understand the work they do. But now it's sort of being politicised and they've been taken over by like activists and open border fanatics that are using them as a taxi company to bring them over to the UK. And then once they reach the UK, they'll have some checks done, which is ultimately just whatever background information they can find out. They'll take some biometrics such as their DNA and fingerprints and such on. But they never used to do this. These are all relatively new things that have only been implemented over the last couple of years. In the early days, it was just a case of they arrive, they wait around in a tent, they go on a coach, they go to Folkestone to get processed, they stay there for 24 hours. Then they go to a hotel. That was what used to happen. Now they come to the docks. From there, they go to a facility like Manston, and they could be there for 24 to 48 hours. Some have stayed longer than a week if there's backlogs and so on, but usually it's around 48 hours. And then from there, they get given hotels or barracks or a HMO somewhere in the country. They will be in those for anywhere between 6 months and 2 years. And from there, they're into a council house or flat. And that's the process. That's just the illegal side, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I shouldn't have said it was NGOs bringing them over. That was a misstep. But I actually do remember in the days of New Labour, a long time ago now, there was a thing where they were advertising. Peter Mandelson was involved in this, but I might be misremembering that. But they were basically advertising in Northern Africa, like, come to Britain, you can go on welfare, and they had kiosks set up to expedite that process in some way. I can't remember exactly the details, but the point is that they were clearly looking to get people in as large numbers as possible. So here's a question then: why did the RNLI go out to sea to get them rather than letting the migrants, the refugees, whatever, arrive at the shore? What's the thinking there? Do you know?
So from what I can work out, I know some people that work within the RNLI and have been involved in these pickups in the middle of the channel. And there was internal discussions ultimately being held where they've been on the scene when dinghies have drowned and they've found dead illegals in the channel. And it's their job, obviously, to retrieve them as well. So they've had an internal discussion being taken over by open border fanatics that the best solution to this, to prevent any deaths, is to pick them up before they drown. So they have. So the illegals have a phone line that they can call. This is it's like a call line that this is operated by NGOs. I can't remember the line off the top of my head of what the name of the company is, but I'll find it in a minute. And basically what they do is they call through to this NGO call operator, and they will put you in contact with either the French Coast Guard or the UK Coast Guard, let them know the coordinates of where the dinghy is, and they will ultimately go and pick them up. So then that's why when you see all the videos of the illegals filming and cheering and going, yay, the Border Force boat's coming, it's because they know it's on the way, because they've been on the phone and they know the Border Force are coming to get them. So it's all the boats have to do is make it 12 miles across the channel, basically. Not even that in most cases.
Yeah, I remember quite recently reading about a similar thing being done, I think, by the Italian Coast Guard, where they would go out and pick them up rather than let them make the hazardous journey, you know, to the Italian coast. They would go out in like a ferry service. And the thing is, you can understand the logic of it, especially if you were an open borders fanatic. You'd be thinking, well, it's terrible. We can't let they could drown. We've got to go out and help them. It does have its own logic. But from the point of view of native British people, this is facilitating the great replacement. It's the facilitating replacement of us at our own expense. Here's another question. You said that they've just started in the last couple of years doing biometric scanning. DNA and fingerprints. Why did they start doing that? Was that due to calls from people like us complaining?
Well, yeah, a lot. From my experience, when I first started covering this, like to go full circle, when I first started covering this, it wasn't a big operation. Well, it was a big operation, but it wasn't a smooth, streamlined process. It was all very scattered. It was a case of picking them up. Because back then as well, you've got to remember, when I first started doing it, it was around 500 that came over in the first year that I started covering. Then it jumped to around 1,800. It wasn't even 500. It was around 300, I think. So they were very low numbers early on. So they didn't need the infrastructure put in place to do this. And obviously with public outrage and then people like Farage jumping in and putting their two pennies in, obviously took the problem sort of nationwide massively. And from there, the border force are asked awkward questions 24/7. Like a lot of the staff early on, they all had to have media training, because one day they was just going to work, doing their normal job that they would do, which would be whatever it was. And then the next day they've come in, and now there's dozens of activists putting cameras in their face, and they haven't got a clue how to deal with it. That's how you used to get the videos of the hostile border force that would try and grab your phones. I've had one slap phones and cameras out of my hands and stuff like that, because I didn't know the law back then. So a lot's changed. And then they've built up all these big facilities to like block us from going down there and being able to film what was going on. So all of these facilities and implications were put in place, not solely by just the people doing the activism or the people moaning online. It was like a domino effect of everything being put out together. And then the crimes being reported on, and then it go, oh, this person's illegal and he's from this hotel. Why is no checks being made? And then councillors and MPs asking questions. And it just sort of snowballed to the point where we're at now.
It's like it's become professionalized. It's like it's become a sort of, if I might use the word industry, whereas before, in the early days, it was kind of makeshift, improvising, ad hoc. They didn't really know what they were doing, kind of amateurish.
There was always a big industry behind it, but in terms of the UK side with the boats, it was very, like you say, it was amateurish, but there was still the lorries and the vans and the cars coming over, which is a huge number, which is still a huge number now that barely gets reported on. For instance, the boats with illegal immigration is only around 25% of all illegals coming into the country. So it's a small percentage of just the illegals alone, but because it's so in your face and so obviously illegal that people get so outraged about it. But ultimately, it's only a quarter of the problem as well. The main problem is the visa overstayers with illegals.
Right, I was going to ask that. But so why do you think they focus? Because the media really does, and politicians really seem to focus on the boats, the small boats. That phrase is sort of burned into everyone's mind now, the small boats. Is it an emotional thing? I don't really know.
There's a lot to it, so there's layers to it. So on one part, it's distraction. It takes your eye away from the bigger problem, which is immigration overall. Second part is there's the people that want to address immigration but are too scared to focus on the problem overall, so they will target a comfortable area. And the other is that it's so in your face as well that it's like invaders coming across at sea. It's like, as an Englishman or a Scotsman or anyone like that, someone coming over by sea and coming to your land is by definition invader. You don't have to be the smartest person in the world to put two and two together. So all of that with the propaganda that's gone behind it is now made it sort of public number one enemy for anyone who comes over in a dinghy. But most of these people would support that person if they flew over on a plane. It's very strange. It's bizarre, but it is what it is.
Yeah, it's like the method of arrival dictates how people will feel about them. So then what are the other, like you said, it was 25%. So the other 75%, you said mainly visa overstayers. We'll get to that in a minute. But what are the other ways? Are there any other ways that that illegal immigration happens?
So there are people that arrive by plane, private plane and commercial planes. No idea how they get onto the commercial planes in the first place, but they do. They get here and they arrive without a passport, and then they say, I want to claim asylum. That happens. Not a lot, but it happens. Then obviously there's the lorries, the back of the vans coming over on yachts. People coming over, like coming from Europe via the Republic of Ireland through to the Northern Ireland. That's a large scale problem. And then obviously you've got the visa overstayers and the holiday makers that never leave and so on. So there's a number of routes that they come over, but essentially all eyes are on the boats, obviously, because it's so in your face and everyone can see it. But if you take a step back and look at the problem overall, it's something that can't just be fixed by saying we're going to stop the boats and put the border force in the channel, put the navy in the channel. That's not going to stop illegal immigration. It's going to make a dent. It's going to help a little bit, but it's not going to solve the problem. Like everyone claims, we put the channel in it, that'll stop illegal. We put the navy in the channel, that'll stop illegal immigration. That's not going to be problem solved. It's just going to solve a quarter of it.
Yeah. So what are the numbers now coming in on small boats? Do you know?
I haven't got the numbers off the top of my mind, but I think it's around 50,000 this year, but don't quote me on that because I haven't got the figures to hand.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I should have warned you about that. And then it's around about 200,000 overall illegal immigrants every year.
Probably around 200 to 250, but it's hard because of the way the government defines it gives out the data and the statistics. It's all morphed in with other data, and it kind of gets very blurred and it comes a grey area in trying to find out the exact figure. That's why a lot of people focus on the boats as the data numbers. But if you put in it, if say 50,000 come over by boat and you're going on past figures, you can assume at least another 150,000 came over by other routes.
Right. And obviously, this is something that you started on, 4 or 5 years ago now. Do you think that public attitudes have? Do you think the situation has got better in terms of public awareness of this since then?
Oh, rhetoric has changed huge in terms of the landscape on public opinion. I think when I first started, I would get all sorts of abuse and hatred thrown at me just for filming. Just for filming the illegals and things like that, not adding any opinion. Back then, I never used to add my opinion or my views. I would just put another boat arrived today, 60 on it or something like that. That's what I would catch in it. And I used to get so much abuse compared to, and then you look at how the public react to these sort of things now. It's like you could talk to the most normal person in public, just walking downtown and say, what do you think about the illegals? And they'd be like, oh, shoot them from the cliff. Or something like that. I'm not saying do that because it's ridiculous. There's better ways to do these to stop these things. But these are the sort of things that people say now, whereas they wouldn't have 4 or 5 years ago. And it's not just on illegals that people have these opinions, like in terms of, just send them all back and so on now. It's very much the public has had enough now. I think, back to your point about public awareness waking up, I think a lot of people, I don't know whether it's waking up, because I think a lot of people knew the problem overall. They were just more afraid to speak openly about it. But when you see a lot of these politicians echoing what a lot of people are talking at home now, you see these political commentators using our talking points. They go on social media and they see everyone using the same talking points. It encourages people to do it themselves. So I believe a lot of people already had these opinions. They just weren't confident enough to share them publicly.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was, and still is to a great extent, it's something that you can get severely punished for. Because even if you say the wrong word, if you use the wrong term, it could be a hate crime, or it could be misinformation, it could be disinformation, whatever. So it is something where the government, the state, clearly want to control the conversation as much as possible. But I think that is a losing battle. I mean, would you agree with that?
yeah, you can only control the rhetoric for so long before people just go, what else have I got to lose? I'm saying it anyway. And then they say it, and then more people say it, and then you're in the situation we're at now. Like when the riots were going on, there was a lot of people that were scared to speak. There was a lot of people that were scared to say anything. But ultimately, they have to understand that you was only going to get arrested if you was encouraging violence. That was the only way you was going to get arrested. If you don't encourage violence, you can still say, I want all of these people gone, send them all back. I say it all the time. Like, but there's a line between saying, I want them all gone, and I want them all gone, and I'm going to burn that hotel down. There's a line. Like, you can't do that, but you can say, I want them gone. So I think that scared a lot of people in speaking openly. But once that sort of bubble sort of burst, everyone's come back round now, and they're like, no, this isn't good enough. I think immigration, it's not something, the lid's been taken off now. You can never put it back on until it's dealt with. So it's only going to snowball into more hardline rhetoric. Even the likes of people like Rupert Lowe and Robert Jemrick, and even Keir Starmer, are using hardline nationalist rhetoric on immigration. Something that anyone who said that rhetoric 20 years ago in the BNP would have been slaughtered for it. Now you've got the Prime Minister on there saying that it was an experiment on the population and so on. Like, that's replacement migration. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah, the only thing that was missing from that speech by Keir Starmer a few weeks ago, the only thing that was missing was the racial angle. He didn't say white people are being replaced, but he did say everything else, that it was manufactured, it was maintained, the government lied about it, it was a unlimited numbers, it was a deliberate project, deliberate. And of course, we've already had that admission regarding Tony Blair with Andrew Nether. I think that was about 2009. But that's 20 years ago, 25 years ago. This is a castigation of the Conservative government that was in for, what, 12 years, 13 years? 14 years, actually, sorry. So you've got Keir Starmer. I mean, this situation now is that they're all sort of, as a new precedent has been set, such that they all are now having to compete with each other to be more anti-migration, or at least to sound more anti-migration. You've got Kemi Badenoch, Keir Starmer, and Nigel Farage with Reform, and these are the ones in the House of Commons. What do you think about Nigel Farage and Reform?
So I'm not a fan of Nigel Farage. Don't get me wrong, I used to have respect for him. I used to have the attitude that he's playing a long game. When he gets into the House of Commons, he will come out and he will say we need to deal with immigration and so on. I foolishly, that's what I believed. And then obviously he got elected and it was just embarrassing all round. The Reform Party, I was involved with the Reform Party. I got invited into the party by Richard Tice. They wanted me to stand as a candidate in Dover, but because of some online comments, they kicked me out. But the Reform Party isn't what people perceive it to be. It's ultimately Tories 2.0. A lot of people think, they're the best of the bad bunch, which is a good argument, that they're the best in terms of out of right-wing parties that have got a chance of gaining power at the moment. But that doesn't mean that they're the party you should support, because what they're offering is more immigration. That's their policy. On immigration, what they're offering is more immigration. So net zero is their policy on immigration. So that could be 500,000 Englishmen going tomorrow and they'd let in 500,000 Indians or Pakistanis or whatever. And that's their policy and they think that's sensible. So with Reform, I just see them as a lost cause. I see them as ultimately, at first I thought they could be a useful stepping stone, but when the leader is coming out and openly saying he's got no ambition for deportations or remigration whatsoever, and he doesn't care about the demographic decline of our people, and then installs a Muslim as the chairman who bought his way into the party, and now they're taking Tory donors who made their money from housing. So it's obvious where their ambition is moving forward with that. So to me, it just seems like the party may have started with good intentions, but it's never ended that way.
Yeah, this is what's so disappointing, because it could have been something important, and it could have been something significant. It could have been a change. But immediately it has, they've cut to Hope Not Hate. You'll remember this, that they were kowtowing to them before the election. And now, post-election, they've, as you see, they've nailed their colours to the mast. And really, I don't know what the difference is between them and the Conservative Party. I don't know what anyone, why would anyone think, oh, I can't possibly vote for the Conservatives, but Reform, that's a different kettle of fish. How is that a different kettle of fish? It's just, they might as well be the same party, except that the Conservatives have got a Yoruban woman in charge. That's really the only difference at this point. I mean, it's farcical.
It's just ridiculous. This is my point. Like, if you look at the Conservative Party, they've got a blood and soil Yoruba as their leader, who's got ethnic enemies. If any of us said we've got ethnic enemies, our doors are getting kicked in tomorrow. It's as simple as that. But that's beside the point. And then, obviously, you've got Nigel Farage, who is one, he got outflanked by Robert Jemrick, the person battling Olokemi to be the leader. And now you've got Keir Starmer being tougher on immigration than any of the other leaders. It almost feels farcical, and it almost, like, don't get me wrong, it's clever politics from Starmer because he's embarrassing his enemies. Like I said before the election, that ultimately all Starmer has to do is reduce immigration and deport a few people, and he's completely embarrassed the Tories, and he's doing that. So fair play. Obviously he's never going to get it to where we want to be, and he's still an open border fanatic, and he's not carrying through deportations at all, but he's using that against his enemies. But it benefits us long term. Short term, it doesn't benefit us because he's crushing competition that could ultimately take Labour out. But long term, he's opened dialects that can't be pushed back. He said that government have been running an experiment on the population, and that it's basically all policy to replace us. He may as well have said that. So all of these have been said now. The window's changed. And that can't be taken back. So it is useful long term, but it's frustrating at the short term. It's frustrating.
I agree that the significance of that speech is that it moves the dialogue forward. The significance of that is not that I expect them to actually do anything, any change in actual policy, but that it changes the discourse. The parties are no longer talking about limiting this or that. They're having to really think, at least hint at deportation. And this is why it's so surprising about Nigel Farage, because it's handed to him on a silver platter, this opportunity, and he turned it down. I don't want to focus too much on Nigel Farage, because I actually don't think there's that much to say about him. I think he's just an opportunist. It's quite clear. But it does interest me, it excites me, it makes me quite optimistic that deportation is now in the discourse. And as you say about Starmer's speech, that the fact that this was done deliberately and against the wishes of the public, and that they were lied to, all of that is very useful going forward.
Because it's not just, no. Sorry to interrupt, it's not just the discourse that's important. It's the fact that it's the discourse in Westminster. That's the main step. So us lot can talk about it all day long. People have done for 20, 30 years. But it's the fact that it's in the Westminster bubble now. That can't be overestimated, for one. And two, it's the fact that these people now will be having these discussions behind closed doors. They will be working on policy in these parties. And Labour are even using deportations as a promotion of their party. They're actually saying, we've done the largest deportation ever, and so on. Like, that's from a left-wing party. So when we eventually get a real right-wing party, things will change.
Yeah, because that's what they're going to have to compete with. They're going to have to offer something better than Labour's deportation policy. So it's interesting. It's exciting. Let's get to the matter of remigration, because that's runs alongside all of this, but I think it has its own life. Remigration is a concept, as far as I know, it was originated by Martin Sellner in Austria. I actually can't remember that off the top of my head, but either way, he definitely worked very hard to popularize it. And would you like to talk about that? Because it seems now that remigration, 2 years ago, It was our guys. It was us. We were the types who were talking about it, who were saying it. Now you've got actual politicians saying that word. And I find that incredible. What would you say about this?
Well, I think it's amazing that we've got top European leaders actively calling for remigration, putting it into policy and so on. Like, this is a massive win for us. It may not feel like it at the moment because the immigrants are still here, but as time goes on, people will realise how huge this is. Remigration, Selma done an awful lot of work. The term didn't originate with Selma, but he 100% popularised it and took it mainstream. His work on remigration is impeccable. So all credit to him. But ultimately, remigration is just policies to reverse demographic decline. It's ultimately encouraging immigration, and it's smart, sensible policies to reverse immigration. It's not the case of rounding everyone up and saying, right, off you go. It's smart, sensible policies that the public can get behind. That's the thing with immigration.
Yeah, I remember you put on Twitter a few months ago a list of things. I think it was the 10 or 12 steps that could be taken that would be perfectly reasonable, that the public would be completely on board with in order to manage this. It's something that doesn't see, of course, our opponents will say that the only way you can reverse demographic change at this point, like the goose is cooked, the only way you can do it is concentration camps and mass genocide, mass killing, and so on. And it's simply not the case. I mean, they can come here peacefully, although a lot of them don't. But let's just go along with that. They can come here peacefully. Obviously, it is a different matter to make them go peacefully. But when you have the resources of the state at your disposal, you could do it. You could certainly make a great number of them leave peacefully.
Well, absolutely. This is the thing. It can be done through policies, and it can be done with the gentle approach. So you can remove incentives. So you can remove the benefits and the pull factors that encourage these people to come and stay. You can remove social housing from these people. There's a number of routes you can go down. Like with the Homeland Party, we encourage the idea of remigration centres and setting those up in areas that could be very much implemented. And if you encourage these people, you offer incentives and you say, this is what we're offering for you and you can go home, people are going to take this. I always hear the argument of, oh, we shouldn't pay these people to go home. And I'm thinking, well, would you rather them to pay here for the rest of their life than their children, than their children? Or would you rather a one-off payment and get them gone? I know what I would rather, because at the end of the day, my argument is whatever works, works. I don't mind if we have to take the gentle approach and the slowly, slowly, slowly get there. Whatever works, that's for me. So remigration is the most sensible approach in my eyes. There are people that argue against it and they say we should do mass deportations and we should go and just get everyone gone and just do it overnight. But that's not effective. You're going to meet resistance. It's not going to get public support. And ultimately what we want is we don't just want the people to go. We want them to stay gone. We don't want to be the government that remigrates all of these people and then we lose power and then straight after another government comes through and just brings them all back. Like that's not what we want. We want long-term solutions to the problem and we want this problem to be fixed completely. So having sensible policies that the public can get behind, and even the word remigration, it's easy to say. It's not so scary. Like if you go up to someone in the street and you say remigration, one, at the moment they may not have heard the term. There is that argument, but that's growing every day where that won't be an option. And two, that it doesn't scare them off. It's not to say that if you said, do you support mass deportations? A lot of people go, oh no, because they're thinking of the worst case scenario. They're thinking of border force people going through the door, grabbing a child or some nonsense like that. But when you say remigration, they understand that it's not just the case of removing people from the country. It's sensible policies going alongside it and removing and reversing laws that have allowed this to happen in the first place.
It's absolutely an overall factor. Yeah, I think it's also to do with just how the words sound. Deportation sounds a bit like it sounds a bit similar to amputation. There's a sort of violence about it, whereas remigration is much more sort of smooth sounding, gliding, you know, it's pleasant. But also, as you say, because it's a new term, there aren't a load of mental images associated with it, whereas you know, mass deportation. That's everyone's got all of the, you know, the programming from the BBC, all these the films and so on. We've seen things that we now associate with that term, mass deportation. Oh, that's ugly. Remigration is a blank page. It's we can write that narrative. We can choose the images that are associated with it, or at least we've got that opportunity. And I think that's extremely important.
And everyone in Europe is also using the term as well. So it's becoming an international wide understanding message of what needs to be done. So every nation has adopted this term that ultimately wants to see remigration. If we're all singing from the same tune, it makes the idea stronger as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that Martin Selner just has to be praised for this, because he really is a hero. What he's done here, what he's achieved here, is incredible. Obviously, it's not just him, but I do think he's the spearhead of this. You've got all these different countries now saying that word, and the politicians, but also a lot of the public. It's become a recognized thing. I kind of associate it with this year and with the Ausländer Raus song, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which was used in the Millennial trailer. Some people will remember. That was all, it's all sort of associated and together. And this is why I think this year has been quite optimistic in a sense. With Trump as well in America, but as anyone who watched the Black Pill stream last night will know, that's not all that great. I actually think that the situation in Europe, and in that I include Britain, is better. It's more, there's more reason for optimism than there is in America, I would say. And it's not a competition, obviously. I want the Americans to be fine. I want them to be safe and good and prosperous as well. But I do think that there's a lot of reason for optimism in Europe. Would you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. I'm completely white-pilled at the moment. So the fact that everyone I speak with supports, obviously not everyone, like there are some people that disagree with me, but overall, I'd say around 90% of the people I speak with, they all want remigration or some form of it. They all just want to see real change. They're not afraid to say what they believe in openly no more. Like, the landscape's changed completely from when I first entered politics, or activism, or whatever you want to call it. Going back 4 or 5 years ago, like, some of the stuff that I say now, I would never have got away with saying back then. I'd have been slaughtered. No one would have even listened to me. Now, it's just everyday rhetoric, like, to the point where people don't think I'm hardline enough now, like, which is exactly where I want to be, because I want the younger generation to be, I don't want them to be more hardline in terms of, like, nutters or so on, but I want them to speak openly. I want them to not be ashamed to be a nationalist. I want them to be proud to be a nationalist. I want them to openly say that I support remigration and I want these people to go home. Like, this is what I want from the youth, and this is what I'm seeing. Like, the younger generation really do give me hope. That everyone got, you always hear the argument of, oh, they're all woke, all the kids are all woke and all of this, but it's not what I'm seeing. All of the younger people, like, for instance, with the Homeland Party, I'm one of the old guys in the Homeland Party and I'm only 33. Do you know? So, but like, this is what I like. So it's encouraging to see. It's promising, because young nationalists are coming through and they're not ashamed. They're not hiding their identity. They're not being afraid to put themselves out there. They're just coming out and saying, this is what I want, this is what I believe in, and this is how I'm going to achieve it. And this gives me hope. And if you look at the likes of Europe, in Austria and Germany, and the rhetoric that's changing over there, and the policies that are being put forward by politicians, there's real hope for Europe and Britain included, that we are going to see change. If you look at how much ground we've gained in just a year, it's insane. Like, it really is. We've gained so much ground that even mainstream politicians, to the point that even the Prime Minister, who is a leftist, is using our talking points. Like, these are wins. These are massive wins. We just haven't got the power to implement what we want yet, but that will change.
Yeah, I completely agree. One other thing relevant here, I can think of Austria, Germany, Denmark and Sweden, maybe the Netherlands as well, I'm not sure, but various countries are talking about this kind of thing now. It's in the discourse. With Germany, well, as soon as any one of those countries flips, as if you like, that's going to have a galvanizing effect on all the, like, an inspiring effect on all the other countries. And it's, I think it's like with Germany and the AfD, if the AfD do get into power, which I think they will, I think it's just, it feels inevitable at this point. I think that they will take Germany out of the EU, but even if they don't do that, I think they have a pretty clear line on mass immigration and on remigration. So I think that's probably the country that will really have a huge effect, because once that happens, as I say, with one country, all of the others, all of the others are then going to have to compete with that and measure up to that. They're going to have to answer to their public. Okay, so Germany's doing it, Sweden's doing it, but here's why we can't do it. Here's why we just couldn't possibly do it. Well, it becomes more and more untenable to say that the more this is happening elsewhere. So this is why it really is relevant. And, you know, millennial has always been an international thing. And this is part of the reason. I mean, we are all in this together. I mean, one of the things that really annoys me is when you get these like center-right types who'll say, let's just deport them all to France. Let the French deal with it. As if that's an answer. Because, no, the French, they'll then pan them off onto some other European country who'll then bring them back here. It's ridiculous. There has to be a sense of mutual respect between these countries. And so that, you know, because they always say this about climate change, it's a global problem, it requires global solutions. Well, this is the same, I think.
Yeah, this is the thing. Remigration is an international problem because it involves all the nations around the world, ultimately. It's and Europe as a whole has to collectivize. I'd love to see America as well, but I focus on Europe myself because I kind of America, the landscape in America is very different in terms of race and ethnicity and stuff. So it's just not worth going down that path sometimes. And plus, personally, I don't know enough about American politics to comment on it to a point where I could add anything insightful. So I don't. But back to Europe, ultimately, all of these nations working together is what we need. Not some sort of European Union, but leaders actually working together, not against each other, not trying to get one over the other nation, just actively going, we all want our homelands back. Here's what we're going to have to do. We're all going to have to work together and achieve this. So it is promising, and we are seeing these leaders come up with these policies and they are working together, but there are also other countries that are not at the moment, such as Britain and so on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's now get to the Homeland Party, because you are a representative of that party. It is something that people will be aware of who are watching this. It's something that has emerged in the last year and a half, two years. Why don't you introduce that to people?
So the Homeland Party, we are a community-based political party. We focus on local community politics. The party is around a year and a half old. We are the only political party in the country calling for remigration. We have policies written on how this can be implemented. The leader and chairman is Kenny Smith. I'm the Kent branch organizer. And the party is growing rapidly every day. We have a lot of young nationalists that are getting involved. We have activists up and down the country working. They're out. They're leafleting in their local communities. They're doing banner drops. They're meeting with local communities and businesses. Party's really growing. It's going really well.
And what should people know about it? Because this is obviously, we've talked about reform, we've talked about Labour and the Conservatives. What are the ambitions of the Homeland Party?
So the ambitions long term are in terms of like long term in. Long trajectory is to gain power and ultimately implement remigration and benefit, make life better for our people all around. But short term and going forward, the main goals of the party are community politics. That is the primary goal of our party is community politics, doing the best we can in our local communities, implementing real change on people's doorsteps, actively working with our people and trying to make our homelands better, starting with the local community. So if we can get councillors up and down the country and making strongholds in certain areas, from there, once we have a stronghold in the communities and we say we have control of the councils, then we can start thinking about expanding outwards and standing for government and such of MPs and so on. But as we're starting, as we have to start from the ground up, because we are very much a grassroots political party, we have to start from the bottom up. And our goal, I believe, is the correct way to do it, is to focus on local community politics, implement change where you can, build trust with your local community, show them that this is the way that we can govern and we can put our people first and with the powers that we have in our local communities. And that will implement and encourage trust and faith going forward to grow the party. Obviously, all of these rely on more people joining into the party. As it stands, we are still a young party. We are still very much in the growing stage. But
yeah, embryonic, yeah.
Yeah, but you expect that from a grassroots party. But as it stands, we are very encouraged by what we've seen. I'm completely white-pilled being involved in the party, seeing all of the hard work that the activists and the officers and everyone involved does. It's really encouraging, to be honest. It's that we are the only we are the only nationalist party in the country that is explicitly nationalist to the point where it's in our constitution. We're not civic nationalists or whatever term you want to add to it. We are just nationalists, and we do what's best for our homelands and our people.
Yeah, as indicated by the name, which I think is a really good name for a party. I agree with what you're saying about establishing strongholds, because I think this happened with UKIP and now it's happened with Reform, where they get a lot of votes, but it's too dispersed over the country so that they don't get any MPs. I can't remember how many MPs they got with Reform. I think it was, it was a few. I think it was six, maybe. But the point is that this is a serious problem. We need to establish strongholds so that that's that area. Certain. And then you're going to have MPs, and then that will be real political power at the government level. But obviously the first stage to that is winning over those communities and helping those communities. Of course, the mainstream parties are so captured at this point that I don't know how many people can have much faith in them. I mean, if you think about Labour and Conservative, I think a lot of people now, there's much more cynicism now towards those parties than there was even 10 years ago. And I don't know if it's strictly, I think immigration must be part of that, must be a big reason for that. I think in general, people have seen so much treachery from Labour and the Conservatives that this moment right now is perfect for starting a new party and making a dent in that that awful, what would you say, the deadlock that is created by Labour and the Conservatives. Because, as I say, I don't think that people trust them. I don't think that people believe in them. I think that people feel very much betrayed by them. And it's understandable why. I mean, what have they done but betray the country for a very, very long time?
Well, this is the thing. They've always betrayed their voter base, whether it be Labour or Conservative. They've always betrayed their voter base. But I think the distrust has grown recently, like over the last few years, because of so many divisive topics that have happened, that both parties haven't really had a strong line either way. So they've always been in the grey area, which makes people hate you even more because you're not picking a side. So you have like Brexit, you have the immigration debate, then you have Israel-Palestine and so on. All of these problems and issues kind of boiled up, and it's made left and right completely meaningless, for one, because a lot of these concerns, you could be a diehard nationalist and then you could be supporting Palestine or something like that, and then you could be like a diehard leftist that happens to be a Zionist or something, or it could be the other way around or whatever, and it could be overlaps, or you could have voted Brexit but you support Palestine, but this person voted leave and supports. But it's like there's so many overlaps and stuff like this now that people don't really know where they sit unless they have a party that they believe in. That's what's different with the Homeland Party, is we are nationalists. If you're a nationalist, you can come with us. That's that's what we've put out to our people, and so we've put our flag in the sand, and that's what we've done. But if you look at like the Tories, you took at Labour, not so much Lib Dems and Green, because they've always kind of had that sort of position where they've been. But more with Tories, Labour and Reform, you don't really know their position on any of these topics. Reform, obviously, you know, they're anti-Brexit. They support Brexit. But other than that, you wouldn't know their positions on either most of the problems. They could say they're against immigration, but then they're going to say they'd let in however many they let out. So it's kind of there's a nuance to the left and right term now, which is, yeah, to me, you're either a globalist or you're a nationalist. That's how I see it. I don't really look at left and right no more.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think that a lot of, you know, the left right spectrum, it almost seems like it's a retarding factor at this point. It's something that just, it frames the debate, and then, but it makes people stupid. There are obviously good reasons to do left wing this or that left wing policy, and this or that right wing policy. But what you've got with this, again, I'm sorry to keep going back to this, but what you've got with Labour and Conservative, the Conservatives bring in gay marriage, oversee the whole transgender thing in the 2010s, and then end with record numbers of migration, of immigration. Meantime, Labour are in bed with BlackRock. I mean, it's just crazy that they, as you say, they betray their bases. The little Englander, the Conservative voter who's voting for the Conservative Party will not be up for any of that stuff, and isn't. And meantime, the Socialists will not be up for getting into bed with BlackRock. So these parties are absolutely betraying their base. And to say that, you don't even need to go into the effect that Labour's policies have on the working class, because that is supposedly their base. Total treachery there. I mean, they have betrayed the working class in ways that boggle the mind. And perhaps the epitome of this was with the riots earlier this year, where you just had this sense of utter contempt for the working class, who have been dispossessed, impoverished, in many cases raped because of the effects of diversity and mass immigration. And Labour just didn't seem to give a toss about them, and loathed them for complaining about it. So I don't know. It was such an own goal there by Starmer and his government. But then, as I say, the Conservatives, their time was just replete with own goals as well. So I think the point here is the left-right paradigm, I think, has... I don't have much faith in it as a useful paradigm anymore, a useful instrument. And I'm really glad that, you're saying that Homeland is simply a straightforward nationalist party. I like that, because to me, nationalism just means sanity. It just means looking after your country, your people, your land. And I don't see why anyone would sanely disagree with that as a good idea. It's just obviously a good idea.
It's the most natural stance to take. It's tribalism. It's in our DNA. It's literally who we are as people. It's the most natural stance to take. So it's unnatural to oppose it, in my opinion. You have to justify it in your brain to even try and think of a way to oppose it, because all you're requesting is the best for our people. If it's good for our people, I support it. If it's bad for our people, I do not. It's that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing I wanted to ask you about was you sort of are both an offline activist and an online activist. And there is sometimes a sort of, not competition, but there can be some discord between those two things. There are the offline people who don't like the world of the internet, understandably. I can understand why. And then there are the online people who say that there's no point leafleting anymore. There's no point standing on a street corner. What would you say about this? Because you seem to be really right in the middle there between those two.
Well, ultimately, we have to do both. So social media has changed drastically over, I'd say, over the last 10 years, but over the last 5 years, it's become very much everyone's go-to for a source of information or anything. So to ignore social media and just focus on, to ignore online world and just focus on street level activism and offline activism would be silly and detrimental to helping you out, because ultimately you can reach more people online. But then to say that only online activism is the way forward is very naive, because there are huge amounts of people that are not going to see your post that you put on the internet or your video that you put out. There are going to be millions of people that don't see it. But putting leaflets through people's doors, sure, only maybe 1, 2 in 10 may actually read the leaflet, but you still reach 2 out of 10 every 2 out of 10 people, which is a lot more if you put the ratings compared to a video, compared to how many people there are. So there are arguments for it. And obviously, when you go door-to-door leafleting, you can also have the opportunity to speak to people at their door. So you can actually have a conversation with someone who doesn't know you, but you're putting forward your politics and your party, and you're saying, this is what we stand for. You can find out where they're at, and you sort of get healthy. Because one problem with the online rhetoric and the online sphere is they come very... This is something I've been guilty of myself when I have a couple of months of activism on, like street-level activism, is the rhetoric online is not the same as the rhetoric offline. Sure, everyone uses our talking points, but some of the words that are used, some of the approach that's taken, it's completely different. If you presented the argument how you'd present it online to someone who's not in the online world, or even in our circles, because even people just outside of our circles don't understand the nuance to the joke or the conversation, it can be more damaging. So say, for example, the first contact someone's had of me would be when I was leafleting and I met them at the door and I had a smart shirt on and so on. And I was like, oh, hello, this is nationalism. This is what we're trying to put forward. That's a good first impression. But say they come onto my Twitter feed and the last post I put out was like some random shit post that doesn't look great. It's just me sort of saying something that to our guys, it's like a subtle, sort of like they get it. But to the outside world, it's just you're being like, to them, they look like you're just being a racist or something like that. So it can be damaging that way. But I see it as the way we win is mastering how we can intertwine both of them together. I haven't mastered it yet. If I did, obviously we'd win. But there are ways that you can do online activism with offline activism, make them gel together. For instance, any offline activism straight away gets uploaded onto online and then becomes online activism anyway, because you're using it to spread around the message. But to deny one or the other would be silly, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really interesting point you make there at the end, because I used to do speeches quite a lot. We used to do conferences quite a lot around Europe. And I would always make sure to record my speeches, because it could hugely multiply the number of people who hear the speech. I mean, it's crazy if you're doing this, and I guess this will no doubt chime with you. If you're doing anything in real life, you should record it, because it's silly to just limit it to the people who were there at that moment in that place. If you record it, then it's there, and you can show it and use it for a long time. So I completely agree. I think the online space can function as a sort of, if nothing else, it can function as an archive of the offline, of the real world.
I think it's more than that as well. So even simple things like going leafleting and such, you must have seen, like, I've done quite a few posts now where I'm like, oh, I've been leafleting today, upload the leaflet in a door or something like that. But that weirdly enough encourages others to go out and go, oh, actually, I can do a bit of leafleting on my way to work. It's not hard. So I can do a few hundred houses at the weekend or something. And then more people go out and do it. So by putting your offline activism online, even if the picture just is a leaflet in a door, it's not very exciting to look at or something. But it sparks something in someone and goes, I could do that. I could do that simple, low effort bit of activism. It's not hard. It's not going to damage me or my reputation, or it's not going to cost me any money or time. Realistically, you can do that when you're walking the dog and so on. And then people go out and do it. In the homeland parties, since I've started doing that, a lot of my branch members have been out and started doing it on their own. So it's very beneficial. It's definitely good for the cause, I would say.
Yeah, I think the summary is that obviously we need both, and it's like offline and online, and it'd be crazy. I mean, in this day and age, it would be crazy to completely reject the online world. But at the same time, the real world does still exist. And there are loads of people who are not on Twitter, who are not on YouTube, certainly not political YouTube, such as it still exists. And so you're not going to reach those people just by online work. So, yeah, I completely agree. There are quite a few super chats, so we'll go to those now. Open Borders says, Steve does an amazing job. He literally watches every day the Camp of the Saints. And that's a very generous super chat indeed. So thank you very much for that. The Camp of the Saints is, you'll know what that is. It's a seminal book by Jean Raspail. I think it was 1971. And it's amazing how accurate.
I've never actually read it. I'm waiting for I was looking online for an English translation. And, they're so expensive now. It's like 70 quid.
Yeah, it's crazy. I heard that there's a new edition on the way next year in English, but I don't know any more than that.
That's with Bourbon Books.
Sorry?
That's with Bourbon Books, the publishing company that does Renaud Camus's work.
Ah, right. Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's a book that has made a mark. He died, I think, in 2020. Jean Raspail is very old. He lived long enough to see the migrant crisis starting in 2015, very sadly. But yeah, I mean, to what extent would you say? I think if you don't know, the general plot of that book is that a fleet of ships come up from India, and the European politicians know it's coming, but everyone refuses to do anything about it, and then it arrives, and it's chaos. And, you know, to some extent, I think that the sad thing about the reality that we've seen is that they encouraged it. They didn't just not do anything to stop it. They've actively encouraged it. And that's what Merkel did back in 2015.
This thing, it's been encouraged by politicians and NGOs and big business, the whole step of the way. This is a huge industry. This is the thing. Not just legal immigration, but illegal immigration is just on that scale alone, just with just the boats and stuff like that, and that small fraction is huge business. So you've got like ClearSpring, Ready Homes, you've got Serco, got many other organisations with their hands in their pies. It's huge. So you have to go more than just stopping the problem. You've got to find a way to stop all of these people profiting from it along the way as well, which is easier said than done.
Yeah.
It can be done. Don't get me wrong, it can be done, but it's not just a case of going, we don't like Serco no more, so you can't do it.
Yeah, indeed. Morgoth did a video about Serco. I didn't know. Until I saw that video, I hadn't heard of Serco. I didn't know what was going on. And
it's a huge company. It's a huge company.
Yeah, it's astonishing what is going on there. Where, as I said earlier, it's a people paying for their own dispossession, and this corporation is profiting. And it's shocking, absolutely shocking. And then I couldn't believe it when I found out that it's the CEO of Serco is a descendant of Winston Churchill. As if to pour salt into the wound. Darby says, Auslander Rouse, nationalism is inevitable. Thank you very much, and I agree. Conservative, this is a joke account, and Conservative says, we need to get the trans vote. Thank you. I don't agree. Hal 9000 says, this is a good question. What's your answer to the Muslim bloc vote, given their mushrooming population, their rapidly expanding population in Britain? The bloc vote, what would you say?
I always say this when people say, oh, what about this bloc or this bloc? Don't worry about them. Just focus on what we're doing. There's nothing you can do at the moment to prevent them from voting whatever way they're voting. We have no power to prevent them being here, so I wouldn't worry about it. Just focus on what we can achieve and what we can gain for ourselves at the moment. I wouldn't worry about what they're doing. Just focus on what we're doing. Because otherwise you end up in a trap where you're always looking over your shoulder. You're always worrying, oh, they're doing this and we haven't done that yet. And then you feel like you have to start going down a route where you're either following them or you're countering them in everything you're doing. It's just not healthy. Just focus on what we're doing. Put forward the ideas for our people and it will all follow through.
Yeah, there's also the thing about don't try to control that which you can't control. It just drains your energy and your morale. Okay, and then Diesel Runaway says, may I respectfully suggest a change to the Homeland Party name in Wales? Plaid, hold on a second, Plaid Vam Wlad is a great name, translates to Motherland Party. But Plaid has too many associations with the Welsh Independence Party. Wales needs help. I'd be keen to get involved as a Welshie myself. So there we go. That's Diesel Runaway.
Join the party. The name won't be changing, unfortunately. We're going to keep it as the Homeland Party because we feel that's the best name for the party. But we definitely welcome you on board if you can get past them, if you can get past us not being called the Motherland.
Okay. One-Eyed Fat Man says, how did the Homeland Party manage to create their party as a genuine nationalist party? How did they get over the attacks? Oh, hold on a second. Oh. Okay. So have they had any troubles with the media, basically, and any attempts to strong arm them into folding or cucking and so on? How has the Homeland Party withstood that kind of thing so far?
So all we've had is the usual smears from the likes of Hope Not Hate and a few like socialist magazines and stuff like that, but we've had no real mainstream media attack or anything like that. So there's nothing to attack us on. This is the thing. We are just sensible nationalists. All we're putting forward is sensible policies, promoting community politics, and we're a registered political party campaigning like any other political party. There's nothing to attack us on. So we're not concerned about any smears that people try to put forward with us, to be honest.
Yeah, it's amazing how much Hope Not Hate need to lie about people and how they're willing to lie about people. And I'm not going to go into specifics, but they've certainly lied about me and many people that I've known. They are perfectly prepared to do that, but they need to do that because the truth is that we're basically reasonable people and intelligent people and well-intentioned people as well. So yeah, as you say, the best thing is just to ignore them to the as much as you can. Ben Gunn says, all the best, Woz. Thank you very much. Darby says, it's time remigration is inevitable. Hats off to Mr. Laws and all of his hard work. Majorly white-pilled going into 2025. Good.
That's what we like to hear. That's what we like to hear.
Yeah. And Diesel Runaway says, extra kudos to Woz for being a good interviewer and sorry for making you do Welsh online. I'm sorry I'm not more familiar with it. But thank you for that. I'll end just by echoing what that Darby just said. I think that you, Steve, really deserve a lot of praise for your optimism and your morale building, because I think it's easy to get depressed. It's easy to be depressed. Indeed, my online moniker would suggest that I am a melancholy sort of character, but you are the antidote to that. And I think that your constant chanting of remigration is inevitable over the last 2 years. You know, people talk about meme magic and make reality, fake it till you make it and all this. But I think you've had a genuine effect, not just with that slogan, with your activism in general and your optimism in general. So I want to thank you sincerely for what you've done.
No, I appreciate that. It's very much a team effort, though. I can't really take any credit. It's collectively all of us that put in the graft to get where we were. But yeah, I do appreciate that. The terms, like, with remigration is inevitable, it's one of those lines where it resonates with people because ultimately you either agree that it's inevitable or you accept defeat. This is as simple as that. And knowing most people that I know, especially in our sphere, is, yeah, sure, a lot of people get blackpilled from time to time, But they don't give up. They're not going to sit there and go, I'm going to lose my homelands. They're not going to do that. So to them, remigration inevitable, it relates to a lot of people. And it's true. It's going to happen. For every reaction, for every action, there's a reaction. And all we're proposing is reversing something that was forced upon our people. So what we're doing is proposing the sensible approach. What's being done to us is radical and extreme. So it is inevitable. We just need power to implement it. And then once we do, it will snowball from there.
I completely agree. I think that what's happened is the extreme thing. What we want is just order restored, is health and justice restored. This is not extremism. Probably you and I, 100 years ago, would have just been completely moderate, normal people. Less than 100 years ago, 50 years ago, we wouldn't. Nobody would have thought us extreme or radical or anything. I think we just, all we want is a healthy society again. So to call us extremist is just absurd. But anyway, there were a few other super chats. I'll read them out. Diesel Runaway says, I love the motherland bit. It's the plaid that algorithmic association with Plaid Cymru are nauseating. And I think people would, yeah, okay, I understand. Construct says, I commend Steve for actually getting out there. But regarding the block vote question, you do need to know what you're up against. Some causes are genuinely lost causes. And in those cases, you can retreat and regroup. So it's about being realistic. But I think you are, and I think you're taking that into account.
I don't get me wrong. I don't underestimate what we're up against. But my point is more, it's not healthy to waste valuable time and resources worrying about what the people who we ultimately want to remigrate are. My argument is focus on gaining power for ourselves. Because ultimately nothing can be achieved. This is my main point when people say there's no political solution and so on, is nothing can be achieved without power. Nothing. So everything, whether it's short-term goal or long-term goal, is to gain power, no matter where we get it. That's what our people should be prioritizing. That's what all of these open border fanatics and communists and so on have done for decades now. Whereas we've sat back and we've gone, oh, it doesn't matter if that person becomes a counsellor. It doesn't matter if that person becomes a head teacher. It doesn't matter if that person's in charge of this business. It doesn't matter, because we just want this. But all the while, everyone's stepping back and allowing all these to happen. We just keep losing and losing and losing. We need to gain power wherever we can, whether it's at local level, national level, whether it's in your schools, whether it's in the library, the gym, anywhere. Like, you just need to start gaining power.
Yeah. And gather experience with handling power, because yeah, all of this helps. And I completely agree. Couldn't agree more. And then finally, Steve's consistent messaging over the recent years has done so much for our cause. Can't thank him enough. And then Privileged Shitlord says, Steve Laws is a credit to his community and an example to his peers. So there we go. Lots of positive comments there, and I would echo them and say again, I think what you're doing is great. What would you want to end with as a message to people? What would you like from people?
So I'd like everyone to join the Homeland Party. That's biased, but that aside, don't be blackpilled. Get active. I want people, like, not just personally because I want you to, but this is what I want to see. I want to see people active next year, up and down the country, promoting remigration in your local community, doing whatever you can, whether it's litter picking, whether it's helping out with the elderly, whether it's sitting in local council meetings, whether it's writing to your MPs, everything. Whether you're online activist, offline activist, next year's the year where we need to push extra hard. We've gained so much ground last year that we need to double down and keep pushing and keep pushing, because we're so close to actually getting over that, to the point where we're over the hill, where it becomes a lot easier to get things done. But we still need to keep pushing. We haven't gained, although we've made gains, we've gained nothing in terms of power at the moment. So we have to keep going. So I'd encourage anyone who's listening to get out, get active, do anything you can. Keep your head, don't lose control. Don't get blackpilled and encouraged into violence or anything like that. Just keep your cool. Focus on sensible nationalism. It's how we're going to win. And next year, if everyone gets active, we can gain so much more ground. That's what I would like to end it on, to be honest.
Good. There was one more super chat. Somebody said, come on, Homelanders, let's get the X account to 25K by Christmas. There we go.
Yeah.
All right. Let's leave it at that. This has been a great conversation, Steve. So I've enjoyed it, and I hope it's of use to you and your supporters. Okay. I'll be back in, let's see what the time is now. I'll be back in about half an hour, 40 minutes with the next one. But in the meantime, Steve Laws, I look forward to this, and it's lived up to the expectations. So thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Cheers, mate. Thank you. Appreciate it. And appreciate the effort you've put in for your shows as well. It must be hard work.
It is, but it's worth it. Okay. Thanks very much.
See you soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.